I'm Allison Kulo.
And I'm Doug Wells. Welcome to Mound Money on KPCW.
Violent crime has declined nationally since jumping in 2020, but trends in retail theft are more difficult to assess in part because of varying data collection and theft reporting methods. That said, Ames Grewart states the available crime data and industry figures cut against claims of a national increase in retail theft, despite notable spikes in some cities. But we've all heard disturbing stories about empty shelves and smash-and-grab burglaries that dominate the headlines. The effect of retail theft are highly visible, impacting people's perceptions of safety. In some places, customers in grocery stores and pharmacies must navigate a proliferation of anti-theft measures, with basic items such as toothpaste and shampoo held under lock and key. Ames Grewart is a senior counsel and John L. New Justice Counsel in the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law, which is a nonpartisan law and policy institute. Ames joins us this morning to talk more about the research he's undertaken. Ames, thank you for joining us on Mountain Money.
Hi, thank you so much for having me today.
Let's start with some basic definitions. There's shoplifting, and then we've all started to hear this term of organized retail theft. What are the differences?
Yes, this is a great question to start out with because the definitions matter a lot here. So shoplifting, I think, a term we all know pretty well. It's also a term that's very easy to find in, you know, statute books and police data. If you look in city data on crime, you can find shoplifting, you know, quantified pretty easily. It's a crime we've been tracking for a long time. It's sort of what you expect. Based on the colloquial definition, it's when somebody, you know, steals an item from a store, usually for personal gain, usually of relatively small value, somewhere under, you know, $1,000, $500. Something we've heard a lot about after the pandemic years, for example, is, you know, people stealing basic necessities. Toothpaste, laundry detergent, deodorant. That's distinct from organized retail thefts, which is much more hazily defined. While states around the country, I think it's upwards of 30, have, you know, some statute defining this crime, they actually conflict with each other, and there's a lot of confusion about how precisely to define this crime. But generally, what we're talking about is when, you know, two or more people coordinate so that one of them is stealing a large number of goods, and then the other one is selling them for profit, either through an online marketplace, through a, you know, pop up on a street corner, or something like that. And usually, we're talking about much higher dollar values here.
So terms matter, right? The definitions of these things, and just making sure we're all on the same page. The data matters too. So who's tracking this data? How do we know the trends that we're about to start talking about? Where do we get that information from?
Yes. So crime reports start with police departments. So when we talk about crime data in the United States, we're typically talking about something referred to as, quote, offenses known to law enforcement. So that is crimes that police either encounter in their daily work or that are reported to police. Police departments then compile those sorts of reports, either at the, you know, incident level, like case by case, or a sort of tally of, you know, this is how many murders and robberies we saw in our district this year. And then they forward that data up to the FBI, which cleans up that data and publishes it at semi-regular intervals. So what's interesting here is that until relatively recently, we haven't tracked retail theft, shoplifting distinctly at the national level. There's a change in the way the FBI is actually tracking crime data, and that will break out, you know, shoplifting distinct from other types of theft. But if you look at, you know, FBI crime data today, you won't see totals for shoplifting. You'll see totals for, quote, larceny. And that includes all theft offenses. So if I, you know, if I'm at a coffee shop, I leave my table to go to the restroom, someone swipes my laptop, that's a larceny. If I go into a local pharmacy and grab, you know, like I said earlier, deodorant, that's a larceny. So these sort of national figures, this best national data from the FBI, tracks all types of theft and not just shoplifting. That is slowly changing. Future data will break out different types of theft.
And you actually researched this information. What caused you to say, like, you know, is there something really happening? What, you know, tickled your brain to kind of see this as a topic?
Yeah, it's a great question. So some of my work and my colleagues' work focuses on, you know, analyzing trends in crime and public safety, and especially trying to see how it relates to public perceptions of crime. So coming out of the, worst part of the COVID-19 pandemic, we saw a lot of people talking about how retail theft was rising, how shoplifting was rising, how, like you said at the top of the show, violent crime is down. But people are very, very concerned about larceny, retail theft, shoplifting. And, at the Brennan Center, we take those concerns very seriously. We don't want to, dismiss people's very understandable concerns about public safety. But we do want to understand them. So, we looked at the data to try to figure out what's really going on here. The sort of interesting thing we found is that there were indeed mid-pandemic sort of spikes in shoplifting in some places. It looks like shoplifting offenses really dropped sharply as the COVID-19 pandemic started. And that's very simple, I think, easy to explain. People aren't out in public. You're not out in public. You're not shopping. You don't have an opportunity to steal. But then many cities saw a spike in shoplifting as sort of lockdown restrictions eased. As we've all seen discussed, I think, in news reports, San Francisco saw a pretty big spike in shoplifting, but then it receded. So another interesting thing we saw is that a lot of the places where shoplifting rose, even where it spiked dramatically, the rates of shoplifting, that is, how common it is, are actually either on par with or even below pre-pandemic totals. So it's not like we're really looking at an increase in shoplifting so much as a sort of return to what shoplifting levels were before the pandemic. There are exceptions to that. I'm calling you today from New York City. It looks like New York City's in the middle of a, prolonged increase in retail theft that started way back in the 2000s and really, really jumped in 2022. Data from the Council on Crime, another nonprofit organization we work with, also shows that LA saw a huge spike in shoplifting. So, broadly, what we concluded is it doesn't look like there's a real national trend toward increasing retail theft. But it does look like there are some isolated, real local problems that are worth talking about, I think, local solutions for.
So, Ames, let's dig into this a little bit more. San Francisco's in the news a lot. Where we're seeing these smash and grabs, a half a dozen people, a dozen people rushing into the store, stealing stuff and running out, and nobody stopping them, right? Mm-hmm. And then we see in the news that major retailers are closing down their businesses in San Francisco. Are you saying that the data you're seeing for San Francisco doesn't support that this type of crime is on the rise in San Francisco, that it's been this way for many, many years?
So it's important to note two things. Number one, we have a sort of limited visibility inherently into what's going on in retail theft because of sort of the data challenges that I mentioned. So, we don't have visibility into really, is the value of goods being stolen going up? And another challenge is the sort of smash and grab incident you described. Police might classify that as a burglary, and then all of a sudden we're out of the sort of we're out of the theft category, and it gets that much harder to track. So I'm not so much saying this is not happening, as the data for it are a little more complicated. San Francisco in particular, it does look like that city saw a real spike in shoplifting. But that spike then subsided. Like, it went up very, very close to when lockdown started to ease. And then it sort of plummeted back to earth to return to almost around pre-pandemic levels. So it's very complicated. I don't want to say, I don't want to conclusively say something isn't happening. I do want to say the data for this should cause us to raise some eyebrows and think maybe more critically about what actually is going on.
And let's talk a little bit about critical data thinking through things that we read. As you've mentioned, like San Francisco, and there are individual areas within the country, but when we hear about individual stories, there was one story that was highlighted in San Francisco about a Target store, and part of that story could have been influenced about how they track theft. Can you talk a little bit about what happened there?
Yeah, this is actually a dramatization, I think, of a problem we see in criminal justice data overall. So there's to put a twist on Schoolhouse Rock, there's a sort of procedure to how, a crime that happens in the real world becomes a statistic. First, the offense occurs, then it is reported to police or it's not, then police classify it, then it gets prosecuted, and then someone is evicted or acquitted based on that offense. So anywhere along that sort of funnel, you can have issues that might affect how statistics represent crime. What we saw in this case in San Francisco, which is absolutely fascinating, and I want to credit the original reporting here. I'll make sure that I, in just one second, it looks like it was by the San Francisco Chronicle, and it was brought to my attention by a podcast actually called If Books Could Kill. But what looks like happened there is there was a sudden surge in shoplifting counts 1 month in San Francisco. And that, I think, would be, you know, very concerning. This one store reported 154 shoplifting incidents in September 2021, 10 times the preceding month. So what happened? Was there just a string of really shocking incidents in this store? And that doesn't appear to be what happened. Instead, it looks like what happened was there was a, quote, new reporting system that made it easier for the store to document incidents with police. That increase was so large that it actually skewed citywide data, making it look like shoplifting had risen dramatically in the city as a whole. It's just an illustration of how challenging it is to talk about crime data sometimes, and especially when we look at retail theft.
Now, what about what we're seeing in the news where, you know, a large nationwide drugstore chain will say, you know, we're closing down a store, and it's because of this. I guess there's two national chains. One closed down, famously closed down their store in Portland. The other one in Seattle. And it turned out that the reason that those stores gave that crime, they were closing it down because of crime, turned out later that wasn't true, and they had to clarify their statements. What's going on there? What would be the motivation for those retailers, and why do you think they're actually closing down the stores, and why are they blaming shoplifting?
Yeah, it's a great question. It's something we've put a lot of thought into too. I think one thing that I try to bear in mind when doing research on any crime data, and really any socioeconomic data after the pandemic, is that COVID-19 caused just enormous social disruption, the effects of which we're still seeing today. And I think when people see those sort of lingering problems or challenges in society, we want to jump to simple conclusions. I'm thinking of, you know, similarly, there's a pharmacy chain that closed by, you know, the Brennan Center's offices, and, you know, some news outlets jump to blame retail theft. But, you know, I work here. I see that there are, you know, fewer people on the street than there used to be before the pandemic. You know, could that be a factor that explained that closure too? I think that sort of same dynamic might be playing out at a national level. So, you know, when we see store closures, it's very tempting to sort of jump to a conclusion, say it must be because of shoplifting. But really, there's so many other things that have changed in our society lately over the past couple of years that a shift to, you know, online retail, for example, could be one issue. Changing foot traffic in the downtown cores. You know, I saw one statistic showing that, you know, around half of office workers are in their offices in downtown cores on an average day versus, you know, versus what it was pre-pandemic. Any of those could interact with, you know, what retailers are seeing. And then, you know, I don't want to speculate on motivations for why, you know, managers might report one explanation up the chain and executives then report one explanation to the press. But I'm sure there are, you know, business reasons that might come into play there.
Absolutely. In April of 2023, the National Retail Federation, which is the nation's largest retail trade group, released an erroneous report that stated that organized retail crime accounted for nearly half of overall industry shrink. It took until December 1st for them to retract that statement. How dangerous was that report being out incorrect?
It's really complicated. And I think it's a case of that famous saying, you know, a misstatement can get halfway around the world before the truth catches up. So I just want to walk through what actually happened. So the statistic got out that organized retail theft accounted for half of all, quote, shrink. And shrink is what retailers refer to as, is what retailers define as inventory loss. So, you know, if an employee steals, you know, a pack of gum on as they're leaving the store, that's shrink. If somebody steals something from the store, that's shrink. If a box falls off the back of a truck on the way to the store, that's shrink. if a supplier sends the wrong item and it never really gets worked out, if a wholesaler sends the wrong item to the store and it never really gets worked out, that's shrink. So, you know, it would be enormously consequential if organized retail theft was really half of all business inventory losses. That does not turn out to be the case, though. So what it looks like happened was the National Retail Federation took the statistic for total shrink, which they also generate. It's their own statistic. And they used that as the denominator. And then for the numerator, they took a statistic claiming that organized retail crime amounted to, you know, in the 40 billions of dollars. So 40 divided by the total shrink value of a little over 90 equals half, around half, I think they said. The problem is that the numerator, the 40 billion figure, actually was an estimate of shrink from an earlier year. It was not an estimate of organized retail theft. So what NRF was really showing was that shrink has grown over time, as retail sales have also grown, not that organized retail theft had grown. We at the Brennan Center, we're very careful with our data because we want policymakers to have the best information and make the best decisions with that information possible. You know, everyone makes mistakes, but it's just vital to be precise, especially when talking about, you know, statistics that, you know, really can drive how we understand public safety and how we understand, you know, what laws we need to pass and how we need to enforce them.
So, Ames, I think there's some people listening in their cars this morning in Park City thinking, a box falls off the back of a truck. That sounds like a scene from Goodfellas. I'm not sure that's a legitimate business loss. I grew up in a low-income neighborhood, and I heard that mentioned a couple times, that a box fell off the back of the truck. And usually that meant somebody was getting some inexpensively. But I kind of want to build on that from what I said about, you know, my background. Growing up in a lower income neighborhood, my father ran a small grocery store, like a 7-Eleven, in this low income neighborhood.
Yeah.
And you know, my family all worked in the grocery store, and there was a young kid that would come in and almost every day shoplift a sandwich, these little Subway like sandwiches. But you know, it was a cat and mouse thing that my father would do. And one time, the first time I caught this kid doing that, I told my dad, hey, you know, this person's stealing a sandwich. And my dad said, oh, no, you know, she always puts the sandwich in her pocket on the way up to the register to pay for it, don't you? And then she paid for it. And my father just explained, you know, this person had a hard life. And my dad was okay with this person stealing a sandwich every day because he knew the family situation, which brings up my question. You know, is there theft? You know, there's bad theft and then there's terrible theft. But is there, you know, during the pandemic, people that, you know, if you're stealing toothpaste, if you're stealing deodorant, what are your thoughts on, is all theft the same? And how do you think about it as you look at the data, the human story behind some of these statistics?
Yeah, that's a great question. And what an interesting story. Thank you for sharing that too. You know, I'm reminded too of, I think there's this sort of motif we see when we talk about retail crime, that, you know, every offense is sort of a Jean Valjean story. You know, you are a thief, I stole a loaf of bread.
24601.
Yes. I know those incidents are real, but, you know, there are other crimes that do not fit that fact pattern. So, you know, I'm definitely not going to be one to say, you know, we shouldn't take retail theft seriously, because, you know, when people, you know, commit wrong and do something to affect their community negatively like that, and I think as a general rule, they should be held accountable. And there's obviously discretion, you know, like your father showed, which I think is really interesting, case by case. But it brings to mind an analysis that my colleagues actually just put out about misdemeanors. So these are lower level offenses in the criminal justice system. Shoplifting is in most cases a misdemeanor. So if you steal, let's say in the vicinity of $100 in New York City, you're going to be charged with a misdemeanor if it gets reported to police. My colleagues didn't just assemble the data on like how common these offenses are. They talked to people in some of the communities hardest hit by lower level offenses, shoplifting, assaults, crimes like that, to ask, you know, what do you see happening? What do you want done here to fix it? And a lot of people talk about sort of the root causes of crime. They talk about, you know, desperate poverty, like you're describing. They talk about mental health lunges. They talk about drug addiction. And, you know, I don't think those factors explain all crime. I think there's, you know, other things going on there. But I think it's really interesting that some of the places that, you know, deal with misdemeanors and face the harms of those offenses on a day-by-day basis, you know, they also worry about the effect that, you know, poverty and deprivation have on criminal activity in their communities, and they think critically about what it would look like to address those.
As we conclude the interview, I just want to go back to kind of the statement that we had put out there, that it feels like organized retail theft is a bit of a scapegoat from corporations. What can we do as we're listening to the news? I think, you know, we're entering a pretty heated political season up. How do we as consumers of information, you know, look at some of these reports or these headlines, and how do we consume these in the future?
Gosh, that is the million-dollar question, and something we think about here every day. We literally have meetings where we talk about how to you know, get good information to the American public and correct some of the misunderstandings we see about crime. I think a good rule that I've seen is, and this doesn't just go for retail theft, it goes for, you know, every type of crime. I would be deeply suspicious of people who offer, you know, a single explanation for why crime is up or why a certain type of crime is up. So, you know, we saw this during COVID. People would say, you know, murders are spiking. And they really did during the pandemic, by the way. Murders spiked sharply during COVID-19. People would say murders are going up because of like bail reform or something like that. You know, years later, you dig into the data, that doesn't really look like that's what was happening. Just time after time, when we do research on crime and public safety, you know, we find that there's so many factors that come into play in explaining, you know, why crime rises, why crime falls. And it's just made me deeply skeptical of just, you know, quote, two simple explanations for why crime might be up. I think it's really hard to do in the news business and in the politics business too. But we have to make room for, you know, nuance, complexity, and just be suspicious of sort of broad claims about why something might be happening.
You know, that was a great question for us to end on, but I can't help myself, Ames. I have one more question for you, and there's nobody I know I can ask this question except for you.
Finally.
And I remember a decade ago when these self-checkout operations began. And I, with my background, right, with my family grocery store, I laughed and told my wife, that's going to last like 6 months and they're all going to take them out. But I'm wrong. Here we are 10 years later. I'm curious. My theory is that self-checkout does result in more theft, but it's less than $15 or $20 an hour they would need to pay somebody to man a physical register. What's the story? Does the self-checkout lead to more theft or no?
So we looked into that, and we actually, in an original draft of this piece, we went into it in a little more detail. I think based on what I've read, your instinct is right, that self-checkout has probably made it easier for people to, you know, steal on the margins. Because I was working on this piece, you know, I read, you know, techniques that people have used, and it's wild.
Don't share those techniques on there.
no, sir. I think another issue that this really interesting article by Emily Stewart at Vox pointed out is that a lot of retail chains have tried to cut headcount. So, you know, there might just be one person manning the store at, you know, off hours while, you know, self-checkout not going. And if you're, you know, the only person in the store, I bet it's pretty hard to keep an eye on everything. And I bet it's even harder to confront a shoplifter if you see them. So I do wonder if the dynamic that you're describing, that, you know, there is some theft associated with self-checkout, but maybe it's not as much as it would cost to, you know, hire someone to watch those lanes. I do wonder about that. I don't have an answer for you, but I think, you know, especially with your background, I'm interested to hear you ask the same question, and it's something I'm still thinking about.
Okay, well, that'll be for another conversation. We've been speaking with Ames Grauwert. He is with the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU Law, and we've been talking about the myths and realities regarding trends in retail theft. Ames, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you both. It's been a pleasure speaking with you.
The One Utah Summit takes place April 11th to the 12th at the Grand America Hotel in Salt Lake City. The One Utah Summit features timely conversations about the intersections of emerging technologies, government, and business in Utah. And we've got Pete Codella to join us this morning to share more about what's happening at the One Utah Summit this year. Good morning, Pete.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, so let's start off. What is the One Utah Summit, and why might listeners want to consider going?
This is a semi-annual event. The governor hosts his economic summit in the spring in northern Utah and in the fall in southern Utah at SUU. Our spring summit has gone on for decades now. The governor's hosted it. And it's a chance for business leaders and community leaders, government representatives to come together to talk about Utah's challenges and opportunities and tout why we all choose to live and work here in Utah.
When was the last time this event was held in Salt Lake City? Because I noticed on the front of the website, it kept saying that it was so important that this year's event has come back to downtown.
That's right. Last year, the event was held in Layton. We went to Davis County. And the event before that has always been in Salt Lake City. So I feel like this is part of Governor Cox's approach to maybe spread the wealth and to reach all parts of the state with his administration, with his messages. So we took the summit to northern Utah, further north in Salt Lake last year, and next year we plan to take it to Utah County. So it'll rotate around in the spring. But before last year, it was always held downtown in Salt Lake City. And we feel like it's important to be back in Salt Lake City because this is the heart of Utah's capital city. It's where the business leaders are. It's easy to get to. And it just creates opportunities for all of us to get there and spend a day and a half.
And my notes here say that the first night, there's a lot of really fun events. There's a lot of really interesting events taking place. Can you share with our audience what some of those are, and in particular, the Startup State Entrepreneur Challenge?
Thank you for bringing that up. This is the first time that we have opened our Entrepreneur Challenge to the public. There's actually no cost to attend that night. It's April 11th. The Entrepreneur Challenge starts at 6 p.m. There's networking at 5 p.m. We anticipate awarding prizes around 7 p.m. The Startup State Entrepreneur Challenge is the state's effort to elevate and raise the profile of all the amazing innovations and entrepreneurs here in Utah. So what we've done this year is we've allowed anyone who competed in the state of Utah with a Utah-based business in any kind of startup or entrepreneur challenge in 2023, they were allowed to submit to be part of our event this spring. And we are in the process of selecting from those applications the top maybe five or six companies here in Utah who will present live. The governor will be a judge. The lieutenant governor will be a judge. Rob Bruff from Zions Bank and Marla Trollen from the Utah District SBA office will be a judge.
And we've got to ask a quick follow-up. I know that a lot of our high schools now have entrepreneurial challenges. Was this open to those high school participants as well?
This was open to college and above. I think we did have a high school team who applied, but our initial selection felt like they didn't quite meet the criteria. But we do want high school students who are interested in entrepreneurship to come, to participate. Let's be part of this. That's why it's open and free to the public. We've got about $100,000 in cash and in-kind prizes, including scholarships to the David Eccles School of Business, Lassonde Entrepreneur Center, Master of Business Creation program. So it's going to be a really cool and fun event.
Friday night sounds like definitely an energizing evening. When looking at the program for Friday, how does the program kind of fit in line with the governor's statement that he's declared Utah the startup capital of the world? What types of programming then has been placed on the agenda?
We are all about promoting the pro-business environment that Utah has created. And this is not just the current governor's work. It goes back many administrations. But Governor Cox has said, we're the startup state. Like, let's create wealth in the state of Utah. Let's support Utah entrepreneurs. Obviously, we want to bring jobs to the state. And building business here is that opportunity. And we've seen this happen with many companies who've gone public in the state of Utah. Utah's got a great track record for that. But it's that type of environment to support Utah business to really create a place where they can thrive. So we've got programming that talks about how our education and workforce needs are aligned. We're bringing the ambassador from Ukraine to the United States. She'll be here to talk about Utah's global connections and international trade. We're bringing a Utahan, Jason Hewlett, to share his promise to the one. It's a leadership promise. It's an entertainment and leadership presentation that he's giving on April 12th. It's going to be amazing. The First Lady is doing her Show Up for Service initiative, Utah's number one for volunteerism and charitable giving. So we're putting together some school kits for school children. We've got breakout sessions that talk about energy and the economy. Again, workforce. We're going to talk about what's happening or what can happen in Salt Lake City's west side with baseball and all those other developments. And the governor will give a keynote address in the afternoon and talk about his policies, talk about his Disagree Better initiative. Also, Lieutenant Governor Henderson will speak. So it's going to be a great event on April 12th.
So we talked earlier about the first evening being free and open to the public. What is there a charge for this event outside of the first night? And if so, what is it?
There is. So we are at the Grand America. This is a high-end equality event. The tickets are $299. They're available at oneutahsummit.com. I'll share with your listeners, I'm hosting the Entrepreneur Challenge on April 11th. So I have a speaker code. So they can get $25 off if they use PETE25 as a coupon code.
Well, that works pretty well. You had mentioned Governor Cox's initiative to Disagree Better. Am I saying that statement correct?
Correct, yeah. Mm-hmm. Part of his National Governors Association work.
Tell me a little bit more about that.
You know, we saw this when the governor ran for office, how he and the Democratic candidate got together and said, we may disagree on policies, but there's one thing we agree on. We agree on disagreeing better. We agree on being civil in our public discourse. And it's important to Governor Cox to recognize that we may disagree on policy, but we should treat others with respect. And when it comes right down to it, we're all Americans. I think part of his focus for the National Governors Association is just to model and demonstrate that, you know, there may be some running for national office who don't follow this pattern, but as governors, they can set an example and they can show that it's okay to disagree, but we can respect each other and be civil.
Great. And let's get back to the event itself. You know, part of events like this are to recognize people that help move the needle in the state of Utah in the previous 12 months. And I know there's going to be quite a few awards given out. Can you highlight a few of those awards and the recipients?
Thank you for this opportunity. Every spring, the governor recognizes a number of businesses and business owners. There are actually 11 awards that will be presented. Our Utah Business Person of the Year is Lavanya Mahate, and she is with Saffron Valley Restaurants. She's an entrepreneur and has given a lot of time to Women's Business Center and other efforts. Our Utah Business of the Year is BioMary U. They've got a team here in Salt Lake City. They're a global company, had some real significant impact during COVID. A cool kind of new award that hasn't been present every year is the Utah International Person of the Year. We're recognizing Fraser Bullock, who, of course, is president and CEO of the Salt Lake City Utah Committee for the Games, for all his efforts. Because bringing the Olympics to Utah, that's big business. We've also got the International Business of the Year, which is PMI Foods, and then some partnerships with some other organizations. I'll highlight also that the governor gives the Medal for Science and Technology in the state. So we have an educator and someone from academia and someone from industry who will be recognized and receive that medal from the governor and lieutenant governor.
You know, I want to share one thing. I moved to Utah 25 years ago when I first moved here. I was down in Draper, and I remember chuckling at the grand visions that the business leaders in the Draper area had for that area, and just seeing it come to fruition over the last 25 years. So, you know, I came here from California, and this we disagree, but we disagree politely with one another, I think has enabled Utah to accomplish so much more. I am just blown away when I think where we were 25 years ago when I first moved here and where we are today. So kudos to the business leaders from 25 years ago. What are the major initiatives we're working on today that are going to move the needle that people 25 years from now will be saying, you know, thank you to the current leadership group for what we did?
I think the governor's focus on startup state will be significant. We've launched a new website called startup.utah.gov. It's intended to guide entrepreneurs through every step of the entrepreneur process. I think that will be a significant kind of combination and curation of all that's already going on in Utah's innovation and entrepreneurship community. We've got developments like The Point, you mentioned Draper. I mean, that is going to be a kind of a once in a generation change for Utah communities and for the business community. It will be an innovation hub that will be there at Point of the Mountain instead of the old prison, a pretty amazing and significant use of that space. We've also got the Inland Port initiative, which is working throughout the state, actually, to create areas where, you know, business can import and export and really thrive. So there are a number of initiatives, and of course, we can talk about Utah's low regulatory burdens, low tax burdens, low cost of doing business, utilities, all those things that just really kind of add fuel to the fire for entrepreneurship here in the state.
You know, you talked about development here. You mentioned Point of the Mountain, Draper. You'd mentioned that there will be some discussions about what's happening west of downtown with the new baseball stadium, NHL. Will the Olympics be a focus topic even while Fraser Bullock is receiving an award?
The Olympics were featured at the summit last year, and I'm sure we will include a lot more Olympic programming as we get close to 2034. But definitely the business of sports in Utah, and in Utah as a sporting state, that plays significantly, no pun intended, into Utah's economy.
I'm curious. We occasionally will have the treasurer from Utah as a guest on our show, and I'm curious. I don't know how to say this in a way that makes sense for a broad audience, but essentially Utah issues debt to fund some of these big programs. And we're one of the few states that, because we're so fiscally well-run, we actually get the highest bond rating without having to buy insurance. Most states buy insurance to protect the debt that they issue so that they can pay lower interest. But I'm curious from your standpoint, what are you seeing from a fiscal standpoint for this? These are big initiatives. And so what are you seeing from a fiscal standpoint of just keeping that conservative nature and keeping things really buttoned down fiscally here in the state of Utah?
You would think that balancing a budget and not spending more than you earn is something we can all agree on, but it turns out it's kind of a novel idea.
We're like the only state that does that.
Utah's been very successful at that, and to your point, Utah's maintained that AAA bond rating from all the credit agencies since those ratings were created. And we're one of only a few states that have done that. So being fiscally conservative, saving money for a rainy day, not spending more than we bring in, those all have a role and have a big impact, I think, on the success of Utah's economy. We receive some rankings for almost 20 years have said Utah has the country's number one economy. And that's pretty remarkable.
Well, talking with you definitely helps make me proud to be a Utahn. We've been speaking with Pete Codella about the One Utah Summit taking place in Salt Lake City, April 11th and 12th at the Grand America Hotel. Pete, thanks so much for joining us on Mountain Money.
Thanks for having me.
On the line, we have Ted McAleer. He's going to talk to us about the Park City Angels, which is the largest and most active angel group in all of Utah. And Ted is the co-founder of the Park City Angels. Ted, thank you for joining us.
Happy to be here, Doug.
So let's start off, Ted. What is angel investing?
Yeah, angel investing is the first layer of investment for growth companies after what we call friends and family. So often you were just obviously talking with Ryan about economic development. When we think at a macro level about economic development, we think about what I call ACE, which is attract, create, expand, and then obviously promote that ACE. And so we focus on create, and not all entrepreneurs should seek angel investment, but but basically an entrepreneur will put their own heart, soul, and usually financing into their startup company. Then they, as soon as they hit product market fit, they often go out and find some friends and family that want to invest in their startup. And if they've done that successfully, then they often turn to angel investors, which would be the first outside the family investors investing in a technology startup.
Ted, you're one of the co-founders of the Park City Angels. Can you talk about what the environment was like and what made you come about with this idea?
Yeah, well, again, I'll tie it back to your last guest. In 2007, Governor John Huntsman had kicked off several interesting initiatives in Utah, one of which I had the good fortune to be a part of, focused on helping to build infrastructure to do more intellectual property related investments at the universities of Utah, Utah State, and regional higher education institutions. At that point in time, we had three venture capital firms in Utah that were fairly well known. We had a real shortage of early stage investment. So as Doug knows from being a part of this organization for many years, early stage capital, you know, we break it down into, you know, friends and family, and then we say pre-seed, seed, Series A. And so if you think about 2007, we were doing pretty good with Series A investment in software companies, but there wasn't much capital being deployed at the pre-seed and seed stage. And so we took a look at all of the good folks in Park City that had moved here to be a part of the community but weren't connected to the entrepreneurial ecosystem. And we said, hey, let's create a network of early stage investors that are willing to put their time and treasure into coaching and investing in early stage entrepreneurs and see if we can get it through the pre-seed seed stage and be able to hand it off to the Series A venture capital companies. And today there's probably 12 Series A and B venture capital companies and still just a handful of angel investment networks, of which Park City Angels has had the good fortune to be the fastest growing and is currently the largest angel investment network in Utah.
Yeah, we were just, as you point out, talking to Pete with One Utah Summit, and I was sharing with him how much Utah has changed over the last 25 years from a business standpoint. Primarily, for the majority, hugely positive changes, not without some growth challenges and pains. But Ted, same thing on the angel investing side, helping entrepreneurs get from idea to where they actually have a little bit of product market fit so they can raise money from larger groups, venture capitalists. A lot of that has changed since 2007 when the Park City Angels started. So now it's an established group. I should share with the audience, I am and have been the chairman of this group for the last 4 years. As Ted pointed out, the group's been around, 17 years now. But we have a membership of about 100 members now. So why, if somebody's interested in doing angel investment, why would they join a group? Why not just do this on their own?
Yeah, so I'm going to take your 100 members and say that about is plus or minus 10%. And according to my stats, we have 89. So we're just under about 100 at 89 people. And the reason that we that we join a group is because it really, one of the three most important things to do as an angel investor is to do due diligence at the beginning of an investment. And so, you know, if I'll just take the statistics at Park City Angels, we see 50 to 60 new deals per month, and we try to meet with 10 to 15 entrepreneurs, and then we talk in detail with 6 or 8 entrepreneurs and ultimately bring 3 out of those 50 opportunities before the membership. And, once those 3 present before, 30 to 50 angel investors per month, we try to take them into due diligence. And if you're trying to manage that process on your own as an individual, it would take up every one of your 40 hours a week. But if you're doing it as part of a collective or a network, as we have in Park City, Summit County, and the Wasatch Back, it's a great way to meet new people, to share your skills with the skills of other people in the network, and collectively you can do the work necessary to do due diligence on a entrepreneur and their strategy and vision for their firm.
So Park City Angels gives access to people looking for funding. I think an important piece that I noticed on your website is that each individual investor makes their own decision on who they want to invest in, and that's not typical of angel groups. Is that true?
Allison, great question. There's really two types of groups that we've come across as we benchmark other angel networks, and one type is the type that we have, where everybody makes their own individual investments, and there's a second type where people pool money into angel investments and create SPVs. We've tried to bring together both of those techniques. So we have actually, within the Park City Angels, created a sidecar fund. We're currently investing out of Fund 2. And in that particular case, if four or more of our 89 members like the entrepreneur, like the deal terms, and decide to make an investment, if those four people hit a certain threshold, then it triggers an investment from Park City Angels Fund 2, which in the lexicon of angel investing, we call it a sidecar fund. And it's a great way to diversify your investments because as most angel investors know, you really have to get to about 20 investments to have a portfolio of angel investments. And Fund 1 gave our colleagues a portfolio of 11 or 12 companies, and we expect that Fund 2 will give another portfolio of 10 to 12 companies. And so it's a great way in a couple of years to get into angel investing with like-minded people, diversify your portfolio, and be able to support the create aspect of economic development, creating new firms and new jobs.
Ted, you had mentioned oftentimes the way entrepreneurs start is they raise money from friends and family. But very quickly, once you get out of that circle, you have to be careful when you're raising money. That's people have to meet certain criteria in order to invest, or the entrepreneur could get in trouble. It's the same thing for an angel group. Can you talk about, if somebody's interested in becoming a member, what's the criteria? Can anybody join? And you mentioned the fund. Can anybody participate in that fund from a regulatory standpoint? What are the restrictions that Park City Angels has for its members and also for people investing in the fund?
Yeah, Doug, great question. The SEC dictates that you be an accredited investor to be able to participate in these kind of activities. And currently the SEC threshold for accredited investor sounds like a lot to some people, but in Park City, it's not a threshold that's that challenging to many of the people that live either full or part-time in Park City. So accredited investor means that you've had 3 years of revenue over $250,000, salary over $250,000 for 3 years, or you have $1 million of assets that are investable and not in your personal residence. And so, again, that threshold is fairly high for some communities, but is a very reasonable threshold in Park City, given the types of people that have a second or a third home, and many people who have a first home are able to hit the accredited investor status.
Okay, so that's the investor side. And Ted, we've got time for just one last question. Let's talk about from the entrepreneur side. Why might an entrepreneur that's starting a company, why might they want to reach out to Park City Angels? How could we help them?
Yeah, great question. Again, you know, we talked about the importance of getting sophisticated business people around the table after you do your friends and family round. So, you know, within our 89 investors, we've got experience running Fortune 100 companies all the way down to doing startups. And so it's important for an entrepreneur to get what we call smart capital around the table and to allow that smart capital to be an advisor and help to coach you through your early milestones until you get to the size where you can hire enough people at your company to you know, to run all of the important elements of a business. But in the early days, you need advisors, and you need advisors that care about not just making money, but they care about coaching and mentoring the entrepreneurs. And that's what our culture at Park City Angels is all about.
Okay, well, we're going to leave it there. We've been speaking with Ted McAleer. He is the co-founder of the Park City Angels.
You've been listening to KPCW's Mountain Money. If you like Mountain Money, let us know. Please leave a review.